Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I am on the air with my dear friend, Laura Redfern. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Dennis.
I'm so excited about talking with you today because one of the things in your career in the financial world is that you describe the language of money as if it is a language just like studying English or Spanish or Portuguese or all. Could you talk about your journey into that? And then we're going to segue into why this is something that women are particularly having to get into in our culture and the way we're going. So that's the format. So could you take a piece of that and start sharing with me, please?
Absolutely. My pleasure. Money and finance is definitely its own language. And I think that's part of the problem that a lot of people, especially women, but men as well, a lot of the time,
yes.
That's why it feels so foreign, is there is a lot of jargon. There is a lot of terminology. And oftentimes in the past, that's been used as a bit of a smokescreen to keep consumers in the dark or to keep them dependent on a salesperson or an advisor. That's changing, I'm very happy to say. Consumers are more knowledgeable, and there's a lot more places now to get that knowledge that they can learn the language. But my background was not in finance. It was, in fact, in language. My career started in English literature. And in that world, there are just so many things that you can explore. So when I transferred over to finance, I was excited to bring that curiosity to a new land that I knew nothing about. And seeing it with those beginner's eyes in my 20s, I think was an advantage to be able to ask questions and come at it from a whole different way rather than someone who just naturally grew up speaking that language. So you could almost say finance, Dennis, is a second language for me. And as such, I'm very compassionate to those who just feel like they don't get it. But you can. You can learn it.
You know, I've been thinking about that because we're in language. So often when we talk about in the original in order to get the meanings, and you really need someone to help to translate to be able to understand it, and there's so many emotions that have to do with it. One of the things that I've seen that you've been doing is that you've been exploring the feelings that get attached to money. We think about this.
Yes.
We see so much. We see like someone has $3 billion, and you go, what does that mean? Or what would enough mean? How would that work in this time? So there are many emotions that are tied up in it.
Yes.
So could you, I understand that you and Tina D'Souza have been doing some financial workshops for women, and I was hoping that you would talk a little bit about that and how money and emotions are tied together in this realm, because I don't see how we can separate them, and we need to talk about it more deeply.
Oh my goodness, yes, that is so huge and one of my favorite topics, Dennis. So often we've been told or somehow programmed to think that money is completely objective, that it is dollars and cents, it is math, and no emotion should enter the conversation when we're talking about money.
That's right.
It's
business. You know, we hear, oh, it's not personal, it's business. And I'm going, but that doesn't make sense.
It doesn't. You're exactly right. And again, I'm glad to see that trend changing, both in business and in finance. But it is slow to change. So part of what Tina and I have been doing is having workshops with small groups of women and acknowledging, first thing, right off the bat, money is an emotional topic. The emotions behind finance affect every part of our lives, from how you interact with the clerk at the grocery store, to how you interact with your spouse and your children, to how you influence the world around you and the impact that you make on your community. Money has a flavor in all of those interactions, and to deny that is just very short-sighted. So something that we always do is to talk about the emotions behind money, and that's how we start off with our workshops. That doesn't mean that, you know, we just sit around and sing Kumbaya or something like that. But what we do is we acknowledge that everyone, I don't care if you're a man, a woman, what your race is, religion, anything like that, everyone that I've ever talked to has an element of what we call money shame. And we've been programmed to think of what that money shame is. We've been programmed to think of money as something that's shameful, that's something that's dirty. And it doesn't matter, interestingly, if you have a lot of it or if you don't have very much. Both sides of that equation have money shame connected to it. And that's a very deep emotion worth exploring. Because if you don't explore that first, Dennis, then the nuts and bolts work really isn't going to stick for very long and isn't going to be very fulfilling.
God, that's so powerful, Laura, because it's like instead of just putting a Band-Aid on something, you're really getting down to the core of it and getting down to why do we make not only the decisions we make, but why do we avoid making the decisions that are important to explore? I can't even talk about it because, oh my God, I'm supposed to know about it. I mean, why didn't I get the memo? And yet, here we are.
That's exactly it. And what's interesting about that, Dennis, is what you've just expressed is usually the tide that I hear from men. Men expect themselves to know because usually finance is traditionally a men's realm. And so there's an element of money shame there for men about, I'm supposed to know this, and a lot of bravado that goes along with this. Oh, honey, I've got this figured out. Don't worry. When really you're scared to death. Because we aren't born with this. And women are generally, they do have an advantage there that they are encouraged to ask questions and are naturally more inquisitive, whereas men aren't as encouraged. They're expected to know. And I think that's a disservice on the side for men as well. But everybody has this trepidation in approaching money. And part of my job is taking the fear out of finance and helping to learn that language to where you can feel safe to discuss it, because it can be a wonderful source in your life. It doesn't have to be a pain.
You know, we've really watched a culture like, for example, women in the United States have just this year had the vote for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up in the 50s in South Texas, my mother, a single mother, was not allowed by law to sign an installment line contract, an installment loan, unless she was co-signed by a man. This was the law. So now, since we're only taking that, this is not that long ago. Now we're going, and at the same time, we would have many widows that would die and go, I've never touched the checkbook. I don't even know what I. And so this culture of going from there to now, and I was thinking about that. My mother could not sign for a Chevy, to sign an installment loan to buy a Chevy, and now the CEO of General Motors is a woman. In 20.
What a beautiful comparison.
So
that's
there
great.
So now we're seeing, now even though we know that women are underrepresented at the CEO level and we're getting there in Congress and all, but this really appears to be that you're in a time of great learning and great growing and helping women to come into their power in a way that is really new and really, really important to be able to address.
Yes, and something that women don't acknowledge that I try to help with is that we have natural existing strengths in finance. We just don't realize that they're transferable over to the financial realm. For example, I mentioned about asking questions. You know the old joke about that men don't want to stop and ask for directions? Well, women don't have a problem doing that, and it serves us well in finance because traditionally we tend to be actually stronger investors because we ask more questions before we buy a product. We do our research before we jump in. That serves us very well, but women don't realize that that's a strength in investing, so they shy away from it. So I try to help women discover skills that they already have in helping them with finance.
That is finding those skills and learning how it is that we can actually be empowered. So in these workshops, tell me a little bit about the experience that you're having. Like, what does a workshop look like, and what do you feel like your role in the workshop is? How do you frame that?
So we've been using a very helpful analogy in the workshop so far, and that is the analogy of a financial mountain, because very often that's what it feels like. That's what it looks like. You're at the bottom, you're looking up at this mountain, and you're saying, oh my gosh, how do I climb this? So we use that analogy, and we look around and we say, hey, look, right here at base camp, let's get everything organized and established. Let's have a map of this mountain. What does it look like? Hey, what are the tools in my backpack that I'm going to be able to use as I climb up this financial mountain? And we use that metaphor. I feel that's been resonating with the women who have done the workshop so far. Tina and I then call ourselves guides, or I like to call it, I am a Sherpa along the way. And by that, Dennis, I mean that I've been up the mountain many times before, and I've safely guided women up the mountain and shown them the beautiful vistas and pointed out the potential pitfalls. Oh, don't walk over there. You might fall off a cliff. But over here is some safe passage. So we have those financial fundamentals as we work up the mountain. And the idea is to move from financial fear to financial freedom by the time that we get to the top of the mountain. It's been a very useful metaphor.
God, what fun. So what have you been learning about yourself and you learning about what you didn't know before you began the workshop?
That's a great question. One of my favorite things, now that we have a few workshops under our belt, I have the topics and the general ideas ready at hand. I just use a comparison of tools, so we'll use that. So I have my backpack full of the various tools, mixes, and what we might need going up the mountain. And before, I used to lay them all out on the ground and say, here is a pickaxe, here is a rappelling tool, here is, you know, and explain all of them to the women. I find that we don't need to do that anymore, and that's been a wonderful discovery for me, is instead to approach each workshop as very unique, and it's always a small group of women, so we can do this, and to say to them, well, what are your questions? What keeps you up at night? What do you want to know? And when they say, hey, we really need to know what a pickaxe is, then I can bring it out and we can discuss it together. So the nature becomes more conversational and less lecture. And that has been just a marvelous journey for me to learn how to connect and serve more effectively.
What kinds of themes are emerging? What are on the minds of the women that are coming to the workshops? And because you give workshops all over, you're beginning to keynote and to be able to give to talk about these issues. Are there some themes that are emerging, Laura?
One very popular theme is retirement. And that's no surprise, as we have a large segment of our population who is beginning to explore that, I won't say uncharted territory, because certainly many people have retired before, but the face of retirement looks very different now than it did for those who forged the trail before. Yes, so different. And people don't even realize, they don't know what they don't know. So they don't even know what questions to ask. So one of the most exciting things I did just last week, Dennis, actually, was I reached out to several people who have retired successfully that I've worked with and asked them, you know, you've done this now. You've been a pioneer in this journey. Can you share with me what it was that made yours a success and what might you change if you had it all over to do again? That conversation was marvelous, and there were themes that came out surprisingly not around money, Dennis. Most of the things that the retirees shared was that they wanted to have something to retire to, because we need to have purpose in our lives. And moving from a job to a different lifestyle, whatever that may be, is a huge transition, just like getting married, just like having a child. So that transition needs to be recognized and exciting and celebrated and not thought of as, well, done. I am now done with working and I'm just entering a void. No, it's a new chapter. Yeah. And most of the retirees I spoke to said that that might be the most important thing, is to have that mindset when you enter retirement. So the retirement conversation, getting back to your question, is definitely a theme that comes up in many conversations we've had.
I love the metaphor of NASCAR, to where retirement is you come into the pits, put four more tires on, and get back out, and you're on the journey.
Literally retiring.
You're retiring, and that's what the going to. You're not you don't come into the pit and then go out the pasture. You're,
right.
And I love the way you framed that about purpose, because mm-hmm. I believe that human beings are purposeful. It's in our DNA. We need that. Whether we are a child or whether we are wherever, what is my purpose? Whenever I work with leaders out in the business world, I ask them, I say, well, how do you connect your team with purpose? Why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the why that you can get. And because you can talk about money, you can talk about retirement. Well, okay, we know what you would do, but why?
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
getting
Dennis,
to those why
key.
Questions.
Yes. I always start my workshops by quoting Nietzsche and saying, a person can bear any how if they have a big enough why. That is the key to what we do, is to defining the why. And then we can get through the not-so-fun parts of budgeting and finance and so forth. But you have to identify that why first. Absolutely. That's key.
And if I do that why first, it will give me the motivation to get through the what, the draggy parts of the what.
Exactly.
As long as I can keep that North Star, I can keep that why, and why we are doing this. We're getting an opportunity. I mean, it can be a lot of different whys. I mean, why can be something that only will resonate with me.
Yes.
It doesn't
it's
have
very
to be
personal.
Exactly the same why.
Exactly. Yes, I have
and
some retirees who what they want to do. Yeah. I was going to say what they want to do is to garden. Or maybe there's another retiree that what she wants to do is to volunteer for Habitat for Humanity. Or maybe another one wants to spend time with her grandchildren. It doesn't look the same for anyone, but they're all beautiful visions.
You know, that's the thing that I love, because in the metaphor when we talk about grandchildren, because when I think of any incredibly successful or any successful person or anyone, they always have, they talk about how a grandparent can provide a vital nutrient that the parent, no matter how good, cannot provide. So that's an incredibly valuable part about, if we're talking about humanity, and if humanity is going through this evolution, because arguably we're bringing more people out of poverty, more people are living longer all across the planet, irrespective of what it looks like in some of our day-to-day tumult. There is arguably more peace breaking out on the planet than has ever happened in the history. More people are, and so this is our opportunity to be able to have meaning in our lives.
Oh, I love that, Dennis. One of my visions was a vision of peaceful prosperity, to stop the fighting and the struggle that people feel surrounding money. And it's a struggle that's self-imposed. That's what we need to realize. is that it's not, money is not the enemy. Money can actually be a source of great joy in our lives, but we have to recognize and nurture it just like you would a garden, and to not struggle and yell at the seeds to grow and get mad at them when they don't. You have to, if you approach it with a more nurturing kind of attitude, it's better for you and for the plant. So that's a beautiful image.
That's lovely. That helps me so much. I mean, I can just see myself out in my metaphorical garden and digging in there and pulling up a seed and looking at it and shaking it. Why aren't you going in there and putting it back in there? That's not helping the seed. That doesn't help. I'm not doing.
Yes.
And that's where those feelings. Where I love
yes.
the fact that you're addressing the feelings first. Because when we have so much about money, when we get into that comparison mode, well, what do I have? How do you deal with that idea of getting people to think about and understand? Because this is another one of my questions that I work with when I work with executives is, do you know how much, if you got there, would be enough? So that you know, okay, well, now I know what enough is. I don't care. It could be $1 billion. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
matter, but at least you would know
mm-hmm.
when you got there so that you would have
so
that.
Important.
Does that conversation
yes.
come up?
Absolutely. It comes up in a couple of different forms. We address it in all kinds of ways, kind of sneaky in some of it, Dennis, because we do want to welcome the psychological part of money in our workshops. So one of the ways we address that question is that we do attempt to quantify it. I use an exercise by Barbara Stanny in one of her wonderful books, Overcoming Under-Earning. And in that, she does something called an earnings ceiling, where she steps
mm-hmm.
through earning different amounts, different salaries each year from low to high. And how do you feel if you earn this amount of dollars per year? And you kind of journal about what the feelings are. And it's so eye-opening for the women who do this
mm-hmm.
to see where their psychological ceiling is, because we all have one. And when we go through this exercise, we can help to identify it and then think around that question. It's a very fruitful conversation. Another way that we do it is by another very favorite author of mine, Barry Tesler. And she talks about, she's actually the one who talked about money shame. That's the first place that
mm-hmm.
I heard about that. But as far as talking about the question of the earning ceiling and how you make money, she says that you need to celebrate every small little tiny step. So she talks about going on money dates with yourself and even having, she lights candles and has chocolate and maybe even champagne that she sits down and does what she needs to do, like balancing her checkbook. And then she has a little celebration for doing that. And why not, Dennis? Why not celebrate those steps that we make on her journey?
And not just, I will take it even one step farther and just say why. Because one of the things that I've learned about me is that over the course of my life is that anytime I try to make a big change, it lasts for a little while and then I fall back, and sometimes I fall back farther. But if I make a series of small changes and work on them in little steps and celebrate those victories along the way,
mm-hmm.
I can change anything. I can grow. So I that so resonates with me, her method of celebrate those
yes.
little wins and get that so that we can get past that. We can get past any
exactly.
type of mindset and blockages
yes.
because they're blockages in my that are
mm-hmm.
that are unconscious and subconscious
mm-hmm.
of
yes.
what I have been told about money, what I have
mm-hmm.
been told about success, that are there that I will not
yes.
see if I do not address them in little tiny pieces.
Yes. And that's, I think, another wonderful outcome I've observed with the workshops is that when you have someone else outside of you, they can help to reflect that back to you and
yes.
also to hold you accountable with that as well. So in the workshops, it's just been amazing to see the power of the collective knowledge and experience and support. The support that the women give each other is just so inspiring to see. I mean, we've had epiphanies and I would like to think some life-changing moments just by having a conversation, because you often can't see for yourself, you know, your own goodness. So to have someone reflect that back to you is just so powerful. It's so lovely.
It's our human nature to look at ourselves as if we were on the other end of a telescope. And you know how when you look in the big end of the telescope and look at ourselves with the small, everything looks tiny, teeny, teeny, tiny. It doesn't change how big it is. It's only our perspective of it. And that's what I love about your concept and of what you're doing in these workshops is helping us to be right-sized.
Mm-hmm.
And
that.
See ourselves more in that perspective. And that's what I love that about and what I want to talk on future shows, I want to talk about the support group aspect of it, because I see this idea of that, oh my God, we don't talk about money. Don't talk about money. Boy, that just delves it into that just drives it into the shame-based consciousness.
Exactly.
And you're bringing it out into the open so that it can heal.
Yes, that's exactly it. There's Brené Brown, I think, said that shame cannot withstand the sunlight, or something similar to that. That once you bring it out into the light, shame can heal. And that's true of money shame as well, and that's what we attempt to do.
And the other things that we're going to talk about on future programs when we get a chance to visit are the money issues that women bring to asking for their salaries, for asking for raises, for taking permission, for this whole the entire aspect of what you're doing, because even in financial planning, some of that has to do with the jobs that people are in right now and how they are getting into promotion and leadership and what they're doing.
Yes.
Isn't that part of it?
Absolutely. And we talk about side hustles as well. That's one of the activities we do, is brainstorm other ways to bring in income, because too often we focus on expenses and tightening the belt, which is important, but there's another half of the equation there, and that's about different ways of generating income. And you're right, negotiating salaries is definitely part of that conversation.
And we're learning about that because there are so many opportunities of growing this pie. It isn't just a zero sum that just what we have, because that's part of the creative process of what we're going. Well, we've got about a minute left. Is there anything that's on your mind today that I haven't asked about or that you want to share about before we close off this particular program, Laura Redfern?
This has been such a beautiful conversation, Dennis. They've touched on my favorite topics. I think the last thing to sum it up is that my vision is a world where we move out of the comparative and into abundance, that we can all do that. We can celebrate each other and our own successes. We can find our voice and claim our power, not to the detriment of anyone else, but to the betterment of all, and help the collective whole. I think sometimes women especially have a problem with allowing themselves to experience abundance and happiness. And we need to get over that. We need to realize that when we are happy, that helps the entire world, not just ourselves. And a big part of that is by finding peace with our personal finance.
Thank you, Laura Redfern. I am so proud to be able to have this inaugural episode on these conversations with Laura Redfern with you. And please, I encourage everyone to look on the website and see how to contact Laura Redfern. Thank you, Laura, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you, Dennis. Bye-bye.